Good evening. This is Bob Willard, and I'll be your host today on Profiles on WFIU. This is an opportunity for us to visit those people who make South Central Indiana that much more interesting. Our guest today is cellist Yannis Starker. In February of 1998, Yannis was awarded a Grammy for his recordings of the 6 Bach cello suites. He has been concertizing since 1933. He's been the principal with the Dallas Symphony, the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra, the Chicago Symphony, and a member of the Roth Quartet. In 1958, 41 years ago, he joined the faculty at Indiana University and today holds the title of Distinguished Professor. 1999 marks the 75th birthday of our guest today, Yannis Starker, an event that is being celebrated throughout the classical music world. Yannis, thank you so much for being here.
I'm pleased to talk to you.
Indiana University is celebrating your 75th birthday with a gala performance. Can you tell us anything about it?
Well, when one reaches the age of 75, I have in the past always said that why 75, why not 69, 72, 73? But for some reason, it holds a fascination for our race to honor somebody at that particular number. And I have always in my life was against having a continuous celebration, because many of my colleagues were traveling in birthdays for a year usually. But I accepted a certain number of engagements around the country and in Europe and in Japan and so on, where they used this opportunity to salute me. But it means far less to me than the idea that my colleagues and my cello crew has came up with to make it into a gala event in September. I have agreed to perform on that evening, so my major concern is that hopefully I can still perform according to my liking, and especially because my partner on that program will be my son-in-law, William Prussell, who is the concertmaster of the Cleveland Orchestra and former Indiana alumni. Also, it sort of promises to be an interesting moment because my very distinguished colleague, Slava Rostropovich, has volunteered to come to Bloomington and conduct the orchestra, and that will be the first time that we ever appear on the same stage together. As a cellist, his name has been made into legend. As a conductor, he was the conductor of the National Symphony Orchestra for many years, and he invited me to play there a couple of times, but he wasn't conducting, so this will be the first time that we appear. So it makes it some sort of a proper celebratory event.
Some of your other students are playing, or former students are playing for this concert too.
Well, then, of course, the events and the activities around are such that my former and, in the meantime, rather well-known cellists in the world of music are coming to join me or us. Of course, my most favorite cellist is Tsuyoshi Tsutsumi, who is a fellow professor at Indiana, who is one of the most important cellists in the world today, and Maria Kliegel from Germany, and Gary Hoffman, who lives in France presently, but he's American. They are going to perform as well on the same program.
Okay.
And, of course, I understand that there will be a cello ensemble, which is a sort of a traditional thing that when cellists get together or cellists are being honored or they have in congresses, that at the end there is a mass cello ensemble, the sound of which is pretty unique. And we had it once in Bloomington at the Cello Congress, American Cello Congress, when 250 cellists played on the stage. And those who are not familiar with the cello sounds were rather stunned of the beauty of that huge mass of cellists we're producing.
We're not having 250 this time, are we?
I hope not, but I think that the number will be significant.
Now, Rostropovich is coming to Bloomington. You say this is the first time that you have played together.
That we will appear on stage.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for cellists, this is the Valhalla. I mean, this is the meeting of the gods. How long have you known him, and how?
Well, we have met on occasion, but we were not particularly close friends all through the years because we admired each other from the distance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when he was growing up in Russia, I was just about leaving Hungary and coming to the United States, so our path didn't cross for many, many decades. But he established himself as the premier, the most famous cellist. And in the meantime, I was doing my work the rest of the continent.
Okay, but you've got him coming here. What a nice thing it is.
I didn't. That's okay. Because, first of all, I am not organizing my own birthday.
No, I'm sorry.
And the fact is that I am not responsible for whatever happens. When I was told that he insisted, almost as I understand, then I was very pleased, and I take it as a great compliment and plus a very friendly gesture.
Well, it's nice to be accompanied by someone that understands what you're doing.
I would say yes, because he also recorded probably as many times the Brahms Double Concerto as I did, and he has conducted it, I'm sure, many times.
You do have, what, three or four recordings of the Double Concerto?
Yes, the first one was in with the famous compatriot of mine, Ferenc Fricsai, who conducted it in Berlin, and then I made a recording with Hendrik Schering, and I also made a recording with a Dutch violinist in Amsterdam.
Each of the soloists that will be performing at this event have a special association with you. Can we just sort of walk through each of these people a little bit?
Well, I think Tsuyoshi Tsutsumi was brought to me when I first visited Japan by his teacher, the famous Mr. Saito, and asked me if I would bring him to Bloomington into my class. And he got a Fulbright scholarship and came and studied here for 3 or 4 years, became my assistant. And then when he left, he was working in Canada and later at the University of Illinois. And he's one of the most honored Japanese musician in Japan. And he's touring all over the world and made many, many recordings. And eventually I convinced him that maybe it would be nice if he would come and join his old alma mater in Bloomington, which he did, and so his children are growing up here. His son is becoming an IU college student now, and he's an outstanding man, and he's like my son. Gary Hoffman was also, all these three people have been at one time my students and eventually my assistants, and went on into the world and made very significant contributions and still doing it around the world on the concert stages and in schools and so on. Maria Kliegel is professor in Cologne, but both Maria and both Gary Hoffman were first prize winners of the Rostropovich competition in Paris.
Well, you won an award in Paris many years ago too, didn't you not?
Recording awards. Well, I got lots of awards in my life, but I was not winning competitions.
No, you didn't. Did you not participate in competitions?
One single one I participated, which was as recently as in 1946 in Geneva. And I received sixth prize, and my student then, Eva Janzer, whose name in Bloomington is maybe known because the celebration is under the aegis of the Eva Janzer Memorial Cello Center. She was the third prize winner when the teacher, and I was the sixth prize winner.
I think I read somewhere that you're not a big fan of competitions. Is that true?
No, I consider it as a necessary evil in the sense that because the instrumental playing standards have reached such incredible heights compared to what it was in the past, not necessarily that the musicians are greater artists than in the past, but the mechanical output is far higher than in the past. So it's very difficult for people to judge who is better than the other, who to engage with an orchestra, who to engage for a recital. On the other hand, somebody wins a competition, winner of such and such competition, makes it obvious that the organizers can choose.
Well, they've got some free publicity in there, too.
And these days they win with the competitions. It was not in the past 60 performances and recording contracts and these kind of things.
There seems to be a great number of very good cellists in the world right now, where, as I recall when I was younger, that there were just a handful. Is this a cycle that happens, or how do you see this?
No. The cello has reached its golden age because the cello was behind compared to the other instruments in being considered as a concert instrument. The cello, until Pablo Casals, was not truly a concert instrument. He's our founding father, so to speak. So that means that now, since the Casals and then the Firemans and the later the Leonard Roses and the French School of Cellists and Rostropovich, Yo-Yo Ma, and so on, the cello became pretty much the most popular instrument next to the flute.
Well, it seems to be that there's cycles. I mean, there's violins, and then there's cellos, and then there's flutes, and now...
But the cello was not in the cycle before. Now, finally, we have reached the point that there are more cello societies in the world than any other societies of musical or otherwise, and there are hundreds of outstandingly gifted and capable cellists around the world in every country, every continent. And that means that from this huge number... a larger number are outstanding artists as well, because one thing is to play the instrument well, and one thing is to be a musician with something to say.
Well, let's listen to some cello music right now. Why don't we hear a recording that you've made? Do you have any suggestions?
Well, it's very hard after 100-some recordings I've made. I pretty much approve of most of my recordings. Not that I would play it today like I did it 20 years ago or 30 or 40 years ago, but I think they are worthwhile listening. So I very much favor maybe the Schumann fantasy pieces, which I recorded with my dear friend and many, many years partner, Shigeo Neriki.
The piece you have just heard has been played by our guest today, Janos Starker, who is celebrating his 75th birthday this year. Janos, could you explain again what piece we just heard?
The piece was the Schumann fantasy pieces, and played by me and Shigeo Neriki, my constant partner for the past 20 years.
It's nice to work with someone that you have a good confidence in, isn't it?
Well, he's also one of my family member, and when he's busy and he's in Japan or somewhere playing concerts, then I play with his wife, Reiko Neriki, and they are both faculty members at Indiana.
Man, you got a ready-made group to call on, don't you? You were born in Budapest in 1924, and in 1999, you're in Bloomington, Indiana. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the highlights along the way from Budapest to Bloomington?
Well, if you are willing to sit here till doomsday, because it's a long life story, not just because of the 75 years, but because all of that happened. Look, in short, I grew up in Budapest, and I was eventually, when the war was over, for a short while, the principal cellist of the Budapest Opera and Philharmonic as well. And then I left for France, and I lived in France for 2 years. And because of my problems of having a chance to travel with a Hungarian passport, because while I was in Paris, the communists took over Hungary, I decided that I have to settle somewhere where I will become a citizen. And the choice became America, because Antal Dorati has invited me to become his principal cellist then in Dallas. And as you mentioned before, then I became, for the following 4 years, principal cellist of the Metropolitan Opera, and then 5 years in the Chicago Symphony with Fritz Reiner, both places. And then I returned to my original plan of concertizing, which I was doing already before. But I stopped for about 8 years, and then I restarted it. And then it so happened that I resigned from the Chicago Symphony, and my much-loved friend who is gone, Wilfried Bain, who built the Indiana School of Music, came to Chicago, called me, and we had lunch and said, wouldn't you be willing to come to Bloomington? And as most of my colleagues all through the decades, we always said, for 1 year, yes, to see. Well, the 1 year is now 41 years.
That's a long year.
Yeah, but I must say that you probably heard it already mentioned that when those of us who came to Bloomington and we were traveling around the world as concertizing performers or conductors or whatnot, people ask, where do you live? New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Chicago, this, that, no, Bloomington. Bloomington where? It lasted about 10 years or so, and then the tables turned, and when we said Bloomington, Bloomington. And today it's a worldwide known Mecca Center, whatever we call it, of music. And I, among some of my colleagues, am very proud to have been able to contribute to that particular growth.
Well, we're very thankful that you've done that, too. Now, let me go back. How early did you take up the cello?
Oh, that's the usual story. I started at age 6 because my brothers played the violin, so I had to play something else. And it must have been a lucky choice because by the time I reached the ripe old age of 9, I knew that that's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life, if I'm alive.
Were your parents musical?
No, not really. Not really. My father was a tailor, and there are many, many cellists in the world, legendary cellists whose fathers were tailors, and maybe that has something to do with the genes of the cellistic genes, I doubt. But
well, then you went to the conservatory shortly thereafter.
I was a student at the Franz Liszt Academy. I was entered the academy already at the age 7, and I stayed there for approximately 8 years. And I then, because my teacher retired, I never finished my studies. I never finished any studies, for that matter, because I didn't finish high school. I didn't finish the academy. So when one of my honorary doctorates was given, I first refused, saying that I'm a dropout. So they gave me an honorary high school diploma first, and then they gave me a doctorate. And so since then, I can't claim that I'm a dropout because I have a high school diploma.
So you jumped a bunch of things in the process.
Yes.
Well, that was right before the war then, wasn't it? That
you were... Yes, I was in the academy until 1939.
And then you came to the West? Is that
no,
when you went to France?
Then I had to
play the opera.
Survive that little stretch called World War II in Hungary.
That was a little tough, wasn't it?
It was tough, but that's one of the stretches of my life. It's been chronicled by thousands of people, and I'm not particularly fond of recalling those things. I'm here.
So. That's great. You have worked with some of the really legendary people in the classical music world. You've mentioned Dorati and Fritz Reiner. Who were some of these people that were great influences on you? And then a second part of the question, who are those that you admire as artists that you may not have worked with, but had heard or...
Well, I pretty much had the chance to work with the greatest musicians of the 20th century. There are just a handful of exceptions. I did not play with Toscanini and I did not play with Furtwängler, but I played with Bruno Walter, Monteux, Ansermi, Sir Thomas Beecham and all these people. And played Walton Concerto with Walton and Sir John Barbirolli, Elgar Concerto, who was the second person ever having played the Elgar Concerto. I played chamber music with them, with Jean Martineau and these people who have written compositions for me. And so, which means that if you live an active existence through practically a century, then obviously you have access to meet the greatest or famous musicians of the time.
If I were to ask you, though, who were the maybe half dozen of these people that you either played with or knew about that you admire the most, could you...
Well, for me, Fritz Reiner was the greatest conductor of the 20th century or any time, and it always had to be qualified, and I often mentioned it. He was not necessarily the greatest performer on stage, but he was the greatest conductor because of his knowledge, understanding, and ability to convey his message to an orchestra and through the orchestra to serve the composers. And then, of course, my idol was, from childhood on, Jascha Heifetz, the violinist, who influenced my choice of approach to instrumental playing and sounds and so on. And then I was influenced very much while in the Metropolitan Opera by the great singers of our times, because Jussi Björling was one of the models for me of what the human voice should sound like. And I could quote also my favorite at the time for influential, from influential point of view, was Maria Callas. And so there are, the list is limitless. And then there are the cello world, of course, that Pablo Casals was the first idol, and then Emmanuel Feuermann. So which means there were a number of influences, but the greatest influence while I was growing up was first my chamber music teacher, Leo Weiner, who was the teacher of chamber music in the Franz Liszt Academy of Music. And in his class were all the George Scholtes and the Doratis and the Ormandis, and all the pianists and cellists and violinists were all in his class. And we considered him the greatest music teacher of the history. But as I said, the list is long, limitless, direct influences, Fritz Reiner, Jascha Heifetz, and Jussi Björling or Maria Callas.
So from those, are you getting the technique, and the other, you're getting the heart, or is it just...
Well, you see, the technique as a question is often misunderstood and misconstrued widely. Technique means liberation so as you can express yourself. Because of the technical perfection of Heifetz, people were not aware of what an incredible musician he was. He had some limitations in a variety of repertory for my taste and for many other people's taste. However, the technical perfection meant an unquestioned authority with the instrument through which he expressed himself. But people were so much stunned. I maybe immodestly say it on occasion, that was my problem for many, many years. Because at the time when I appeared on the scene, the way I produced cello playing surprised people to such an extent that they didn't listen to the music. They were just fascinated that I wasn't moving around like an actor and with exaggerated motions, and the music wasn't in place. The notes were in tune, I wasn't scratching, and I didn't swell notes left and right, which is customary all through the ages. And so it took them long, long, long time, in some instances, to discover he's basically a Bach player or Brahms player or this player or that player. They were stunned by the technical proficiency. Same thing with Fritz Reiner. Fritz Reiner was an incredible musician, except that he did not move around on the stage and the orchestra played like no other orchestra before. So we can discuss technique. Technique is so as to free yourself to express yourself and tell the poetry the way you plan to do it.
But then we get back to Callas, who wasn't technically proficient all the time.
Callas, when I was watching her in Edinburgh and for 2.5 hours singing pretty mediocre way, but then the last 20 minutes was the most stunning perfection and emotion and a drama and everything what you wanted, that she couldn't sustain that through a whole performance of an opera, that's something else. But what she did, the colors of her voice, sometimes it was criticized that it was breaking between ranges. It was a joke, as far as I was concerned. She produced a variety of colors which I seldom heard before. And Björling was also a perfectionist who, even if when he was under the confluence of alcohol, he still produced the most glorious sounds and phrases that I've heard from anyone.
He had a tear in his voice or something that just grabbed you. I just want to touch on Fritz Reiner again. How could he make such emotional music out of all that Richard Strauss and so forth, and the Rossini overtures and the Wagner and everything that he recorded in those days?
Because he didn't have to flail his hands or his body. Because when he lifted up a little bit his right foot and about an inch from the podium and then came down, there was the greatest fortissimo ever coming out of the Chicago Symphony. And his knowledge of the score was such that he could write down all 9 Beethoven symphonies and the Strauss literature from memory, score it, not just the melody lines. That means that if he looked at somebody and blinked his left eye, then the bassoon came in, or the right eye, whichever way the orchestra was seated. He did not need all those movements. Besides, he learned that from, in some sense, was influenced by Strauss. Richard Strauss himself as a conductor moved very little. But the motion is totally unrelated to the musical results.
Do you have any thoughts of any future recordings or performances that are coming up in the future?
of mine. Mm-hmm. God forbid, I have no intention of making any more recordings. I've done more than I think anybody up to this point, cello recordings. I still have some, two particular recordings that may or may not come before, to record the Brahms double concerto and the Beethoven triple concerto with my son-in-law, and a Saint-Saëns piece which we played here in Bloomington not too long ago, Le Poète et la Muse of Saint-Saëns, with my daughter.
Oh.
But that's just for family reasons. Otherwise, I'm totally disinterested in anyone making recordings.
Well, then let's listen to a recording you've made before today, if we could. What might that be?
Something like the Brahms Sonata with my dear friend Rudolf Buchbinder, who is one of the great pianists of our time, and I had with him several years a trio with Josef Suk as well. Maybe that would be of interest to hear.
I think it will be. We have just heard a little bit of Brahms, played by our guest, Janos Starker. What is the piece that we just heard?
That's the F major sonata of Brahms and the last movement of it, where my partner was Rudolf Buchbinder, one of the great pianists of our times, who was also a trio partner of mine.
It seems to me you've mentioned, you know, Barbaroli and Toscanini, and then we have Rostropovich. These are all cellists who have become conductors. What leads them into that direction?
I'm thinking as recently as about 40-some years ago, I wrote an article which was published, Why Cellists Become Conductors. And among the many reasons is first of all, they get sometimes frustrated that the repertoire is not as wide as for the violin or for the piano. Then, in the olden days, they didn't have enough chances to perform because there were not that much demand for cellists. Then, if they are playing in the orchestra, they always think that where the first cellists or the cellists sit, they can hear better than the conductor. So they think the conductor has bad ears. They have good ones, so they become conductors, get on the podium, and then they hear just as much as the previous one. And then, of course, the cellists have the bass line. So they feel that the construction is, understanding of the construction of the work is theirs and not for somebody who's a pianist or something. And then, of course, the end of reason is that while they are playing less notes than the other members of the orchestra, they can eye the audience and they find themselves a lovely lady who inherits lots of money so they can afford to become conductor.
That's why they become a conductor. Now, you've been teaching at IU since 1958, and can we talk a little bit about your philosophy of teaching, the things you stress, what are you trying to get from each of your students as an individual?
That's about the simplest subject for me to tackle because I've stated it so many times that I am trying to teach the skill of instrumental playing first and the skill of music making so as they can find their own way of expressing themselves, but freed from mechanical difficulties. That relates to the same thing that I talked before about the conducting of Reiner and so on.
Or Heifetz, yes.
Which means my role is to inform them and to facilitate so they can reach the maximum of their God or nature or mother-given talents. All what I can do is to inform them and induce them so as they understand the principles behind how to use their bodies and how the relationship to the instrument is supposed to be, and therefore learn the geography of the instrument, and we can go on to the details, but the details are unimportant. The main thing is to learn the skill of instrumental playing and then learn the laws and regulations of music making and therefore feed themselves so they can express themselves and write poetry.
Well, hasn't this happened with you? If you re-listen to the early Bach suites to the recent one, there are differences as you...
I hope so. Can you imagine? The first time I recorded Bach's suite was in 1950. What changes is the significance of certain elements. At the very beginning, yes, one strives to come as close to exactness, perfection, because nobody ever reaches perfection, but it's a road. At the beginning, one aims as much technical perfection and musical correctness as possible. Then as time goes on, then one starts looking much more for construction elements, relationship of one movement to another, and how to build a whole structure from the first movement, and considering what will happen at the end. And then, when you get older, then usually the emotional content of music is the one that fascinates you, the colors, timings, and so on.
Is this what you try to achieve when you do a performance? What is the ultimate thing you're trying to get across?
See, there are awful lot of different views on that, and people are talking about it, my respected colleagues sometimes, and throwing around sentences which annoys me, to tell you. When one goes on stage as a professional musician, you're supposed to prepare yourself maximally, and no matter what the conditions are, produce as close to your ideal as possible. When I'm on stage, that's my objective, to serve music, the composer, not by blindly adhering to the score, because that's very elementary, and then to hopefully give joy to a public on that particular evening.
What do you feel about this, quote, authentic movement in music making?
You just fell into the trap of my favorite subject.
Oh, good.
I am not interested in authenticity. I'm interested in presentation with authority.
Can you expand on that?
It's clear. I'm not pretending ever that I played Bach as Bach wanted it. In spite of all the reading that I've done on the subject, I take it into consideration how it might have been, but I don't feel that in the 20th century, the end of the 20th century, just before the 21st, I can pretend to feel like the contemporaries of Bach felt at the time when they played the suites. So which means on the contemporary instrument with its high pitch tuning and with the steel strings and with the end pin and with the bow as it is today, I have absolutely no intention of producing an authentic performance of Bach suites. I view Bach differently from Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert, Brahms, and we can go on, and the 20th century composers, and I present my views of Bach with my contemporary mind.
Is this the way you feel, then, that if Bach wrote it today, this is the way it would be performed?
Well, as jokingly sometimes say that if Bach would listen today, he would be delighted that finally people can play the way he imagined it in his mind.
The modern instruments make it that much different? Or?
The modern instrument makes a huge difference, but now it's not the question of better or worse. It's just different. It's another era. I cannot pretend that with my late 20th century old mind, I could imitate the things, and some of the Baroque players are doing that. Some of them are doing terrifically well by using the ancient instruments with the ancient tuning, with the gut strings, and playing the cello without an end pin, and with old bows, and so on. But hopefully they do it in the same small circumstances, the same small halls as in Bach's time. Because what I don't like is when they go into Carnegie Hall and do this kind of... that I find it that it's phony, false, wrong.
I think I touched a point there where you have some opinions.
Oh, I have pretty strong opinions, and luckily at my age I can afford them.
Now, if I came to you or someone who has got talent in any instrument came to you and said, I want to make a career as a solo performer, what would be the major issues of advice that you would give to them?
I would tell the person to go home and quit.
Well, I was hoping you'd expand on that a little more.
Now, for the simple reason that nobody's supposed to go into music with the strict idea, I want to be a soloist. If you want to be a musician, then I will help you. And if God gave you all those talents which allows somebody to become a soloist or a national soloist or international soloist, that's a later step. I did not go into playing the cello by imagining myself that I will be the reincarnation of Kazantz or somebody. I went into try to play the instrument as well as I can, try to make and live music as it's the most important thing for me, next to eating and drinking and making love. But the fact is that when you are single-mindedly soloist, that's a totally wrong attitude.
Okay, well, let me condition this then and forget the soloist part of it. If someone said they want to make music making as their living, what would be your advice to them?
Well, to learn as much about it as possible and as early age as possible and practice and practice and practice. As the joke goes, then you can get to Carnegie Hall. Maybe. But the important thing is that whatever area a musician spends his time or her time with, whether it's the last end of an orchestra, whether it's in a chamber music setup, whether it's in a jazz band or whatnot, you contribute to music, so the contribution that matters. The important thing is not how famous you become.
I noticed that a number of great players, and I say great, these are from a layman's point of view, the names that we recognize, love to play chamber music. And what is it about that that seems to be so important in the study of music or just in living it?
Because most of us consider that chamber music, the writing of chamber music and the works for chamber ensembles is the purest kind of music ever written. When you play Mozart quartets and Haydn quartets and Beethoven quartets, there is nothing matches it. Naturally, you need a little more advanced exposure to this kind of works so as to understand and perceive the content of that music. But this is what prompts musicians that when, even if they are not string quartet members or trio members, that's the one thing that to refresh their soul they like to do at home. And most of us are that way. But it's because of the works themselves, the quality of those works. I happen to be a cellist, but
yes.
The same feeling is for violinist, and the same feeling is for pianist, that when they're playing a Schumann quintet or a Brahms quintet or Mozart trios or whatnot.
As we run out of time here, unfortunately, I do have one further question. Your career has been long and very illustrious. And what values do you hold the most important in your life that have helped make this career so wonderful?
It's simple, because this is what this celebration is all about, that my students come from all over the world and they are all contributing heavily to the cause of music. For me, that's the greatest satisfaction. Naturally, I had those thousands of concerts, and I had the ovations, and I had the reviews, some bad, some good, whatnot, and I had all kinds of honors and so on. For me, singularly, the most important aspect is what my students have done and that I have helped them toward their goals and toward their contributions. And beyond that, I have a gorgeous wife, and I have two beautiful daughters and two grandchildren. And luckily, my daughters are married to terrific two guys. So which means I was not interested in the glory of the field. I was interested in to justify my life, and I think I've done it.
And pass on the experience. Well, this has been wonderful. Our guest is Janos Starker, the cellist, Grammy Award-winning performer, member of the faculty for 41 years here at Indiana University, who will be honored on September 14th at the Musical Arts Center in a special gala performance to celebrate his 75th birthday. Janos, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, let's finish with something else. One last piece of music. What would you like to go out on?
I think what I would think of is a piece by Popper, which was to the memory of my parents.
Well, let's hear it. ¶¶
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in August of 1999. Christina Kuzmich, producer. Engineering and editing by Michael Paskash. For WFIU, thanks for listening.